All right. Well, welcome everybody to this episode of Coffee and Issues Show with myself and Mr. Michael Lejeune, Managing Partner at RSM Federal. And also today we've got a special guest, and that is Mr. Stephen Coprince. He's a faculty instructor and legal analyst here at Govology. He's a founder and also former managing partner of Coprince McCall Potroth LLC. I'm sure a lot of you know Stephen, and if not, it's a blessing to also have him on a show like this where we're going to be unraveling a lot of things that's currently happening with some proposed rule changes. So, Michael and Stephen, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. So we're going to get down to business for maybe the folks that are not quite aware of what's going on right now with a bunch of proposed changes coming out of the SBA. And there's a comment period on this. And we want to really get a lot of good information to folks out there. And there's a lot inside of these proposed changes. But can you kind of unravel this a little bit for us and tell us what we're looking at today and why we're here?
Absolutely. So first off, I'm going to read you the title that they have on the Federal Register today. The Ownership and Control and Contractual Assistance Requirements for the 8A Business Development Program, which is a lot to say in one sentence, but it's also very misleading that it's only the 8A program. These sets of proposed rule changes impact literally every socioeconomic status in a lot of different facets of every single status. We're talking about things that impact contract bundling, price analysis, change of ownership. One of the interesting ones is if you owe money, you're not getting your 8A. It doesn't really matter, apparently, if you have a payment plan set up, things like that. Who can initiate size protests, status protests, all kinds of different things that are bundled in here. But when I started going through the document, which it's like 311 pages, I was seeing stuff for WSB and HubZone and SDWSB and BOSB and all these different things that were all mixed in there. And I was like, hold up, this is not just proposed changes to 8A. This is proposed changes to everything. So that's the start of this, is understanding if you have a status, this most likely impacts you, the changes they're recommending here. And there's 311 pages of it. Now, part of the reason we're doing this is my partner, Josh, who's also a faculty member here with Govology, does a lot of webinars. If you're on here, you probably have seen a webinar with Josh. He wrote this huge article. I think his article was almost 28 pages to summarize the 311 pages. I think he picked out 25 key changes in there that he was like, this is a big deal. So think about that. Out of 311 pages, the summary is like 28 pages, and there was a minimum of 25 big changes that he found in there. And some of them are clarifications. Like the first one at the front was, a lot of people still think if you have an 8A JV, you can only win 3 contracts. That hasn't been true for a while, but they clarified that language. So there's some clarifying language. And then there's some stuff where they're like, hey, we want to make this change. And we're curious what the world thinks about that. So the first thing is, there's a lot to digest here. We're going to get into some different pieces of that. Stephen's going to really help us kind of do almost an informal SWOT analysis of that. But then the second piece here is, I would highly, highly recommend, if there's something in here that impacts you and you want to tell the government something about this, the comment period is open till November 9th, I believe, or I'm sorry, it's November 8th. And this is your chance to talk to the government and make your recommendations about this. Doesn't mean they're going to listen to you, but the opportunity to talk to them about it is now, not after the comment period. That would be my second really biggest takeaway. I think we're going to put some links to the summarized article, because we want you to be able to go ahead and read the article on this. I think that's really, really important. So I'm going to go ahead and do that now. There's a link to it in the article as well. Then we're going to try to cover as much as we can today, but there's no way we're even going to get through maybe a half a dozen of these topics today on the podcast. There's just too much to cover.
Awesome, man. Hey, thank you. That was a great introduction to that. And also kudos on Josh for going that deep in it, and I highly encourage everybody to go and read Josh's article. It was wonderful. He must have pulled an all-nighter to get that one done, because I'm like, wow.
He did. I remember I connected with him at like 11 in the morning, and he was already an hour or two into reading the document. And then I remember him posting this like late that night. I don't remember what time it was, but he literally just worked like 9 hours straight on reading and summarizing the stuff. So
that's awesome, man. I got to tell you, I'm so excited to see that so many people are interested in this topic. We've had almost 300 people that registered to come into the call with us here today. And the reason why that excites me is because it's important to get your education in the government marketplace, but it is also important to keep up with all of what's going on and have a source for that, whether it's a really great blog or podcast that you follow. Have a source for that, because there's typically three things that happen when these changes happen. Either one, there's no effect to your business. So, okay, cool. But it's good to be able to know where to go to look to see if these things are going to impact your business. The number two thing is that it could have a negative impact. It could be a threat to your business in some way. So that's also good to know so that you can get ahead of this and maybe start to think about how you might mitigate the threat of these changes. But number three is it also provides a new opportunity that didn't exist maybe before. And so I'd like to bring you on, Stephen, and talk about what do you see in all of this? And maybe what do you see as potential threats or maybe potential opportunities for businesses out there? And I know Michael said that there's a lot in this. So maybe what are some of your maybe top 3 to 5 things with the proposed changes that you might comment on or suggest that the folks that are watching this podcast take the time to go and make comments to the SBA on?
Thank you for having me again. It's a lot of fun to be here. Great introduction from Michael, and I would definitely endorse what he said there. First of all, this is not a rule just about 8A. The title is misleading. A lot of busy people are maybe going to skip by that and say that doesn't impact me. And instead, it's a comprehensive look at all the size rules that SBA has for all its 4 major socioeconomic programs: 8A, service-disabled, veteran-owned, small business, hub-zone, woman-owned, as well as the underlying small business size rules. And it's all packed in this rule. So it's good to see there's so many people who are here, because that means that the title alone has not scared everybody off or misled them into thinking that this doesn't necessarily apply to them. The second big picture for me is, overall, when these rules came out back when I was practicing law, I was kind of in the Josh Frank position, right? I was the one who was like, all right, hold the presses, cancel my calls. I got to read through this whole 300-page document really fast, pick out the key pieces, do the article. I want it to be the first one, but I also want to be the best, you know, because I got to get first impression and be best. So it was nice to have a little more time to digest this thing this time around, since I wasn't trying to do that. But Josh did an incredible job. I think everyone who's on this podcast should definitely read his article, because it's really well written and really comprehensive. But I think what SBA was doing here, even though the title is misleading, is two big picture things. One is SBA has clearly had its ear to the ground. They've been listening to industry. They have been listening to people like me in my former position as an attorney. Where is the confusion with their regulations? Where are their holes in their regulations? Where are there places where people are getting it wrong? And so SBA in this rulemaking has done a lot of filling in gaps. And I can tell you, there are a couple clients out there that I build a fairly good bit of money to try to fill the gap. Like, how does the rule apply in this case? And the rule just didn't say. And there wasn't any case law that said. And so we tried to fill in the gaps. And SBA has actually filled in a couple of those gaps where I had to just give a legal opinion to a client saying, well, in my opinion, the rule has to mean X because that's the only thing that makes sense. And I can talk a little bit more about a couple of those. So I'm really glad that SBA seems to have had its ear to the ground, is paying attention to industry, is filling in the blanks, both where there maybe was some confusion about the rules, or in cases, I think this is important too, where SBA would do things as a matter of policy, but not as a matter of rule. And that is a dangerous thing to get into too, a dangerous situation for an agency to get into, because it assumes a level of knowledge that the average small business probably doesn't have. And so people could call me and they'd say, what do you think about X? And having dealt with SBA for years, I'd say, well, I can tell you the rules is very vague or doesn't even say, but here's what SBA does as a matter of policy. I know because I've seen this situation come up over and over and over, so I know how they treat that internally. So in this rulemaking, SBA also, and this is again a positive, I think, did a fair bit of, okay, well, this has been a matter of policy. Let's actually put it in the rule so that people who don't have to have an attorney or somebody else who's got insider information as to SBA's practices to decipher what the rule means, because that's not really fair. I mean, the rule should tell you what it means. You shouldn't need someone who's had a lifetime of experience or many years of experience at SBA to tell you what your obligations are as a federal contractor. So those are good things. I think SBA was trying to do that. And I think they were also trying to then, and I think Michael alluded to this in kind of the let's find the things that are really important, also make some changes that maybe have been percolating for a little while, either things that SBA has seen out there that aren't going the way they want, or some of the confusion that has led them to think maybe we need to do things a little bit differently. And so there's no real one show-stopping change in this rule. It's a lot of changes, a lot of relatively small changes that for a particular business might be big. And so let me just cover just a couple opportunities and threats realm. And I'm going to bounce around a little because that's what this rule does. It bounces around to different small business topics. So let's talk first about opportunity side. So on the opportunity side, one of the things that struck me about this rule, and something that I've complained about, it's not an area of confusion, but an area, again, where I think SBA was listening to industry that I complained about, was the size threshold for being certified as a woman-owned small business, economically disadvantaged woman-owned small business, or a service-disabled veteran-owned small business, or VOSB. And so the size threshold, how big a business can be certified in those programs? And the answer for SBA on the EDWSB side, economically disadvantaged woman-owned small business side, and on the SDVOSB-VOSB side, you have to be small in your primary NAICS code, in your primary industry, in order to get that certification. That's their rule for those programs. And to me, that always didn't make any sense. I said, well, that's not really fair, if you ask me. You have to be small in your primary line of work, but what about if you're small in that line of work, but you want to bid on a contract with a higher size standard that happens to be set aside, or you're not small in your primary? So let's say you're a plumbing company. And what's the size standard for plumbing? I think it's like 16.5 for the HVAC plumbing industry. So it's especially trade construction company. Let's say you're a $20 million business, but your primary line of work has been plumbing, still is plumbing. And saying you want to be certified as an EDWOSB, but you want to bid general construction contracts, $39.5 million size standard. And so you can't do that under the current rules, because even though you're way smaller than the size standard on those EDWSB contracts you want to bid on, the general construction codes, you're not small in your primary line of work. So you're essentially being penalized because your primary business is something else, even though maybe you're trying to shift that into a line of work with a different NAICS code. And so this does present an opportunity now for those businesses that have sized out of their primary NAICS, because what SBA is proposing to do is say, you know what? You need to just be small in any NAICS code in which you do work. That's what I've always said should be the case. If you can show that, hey, I want to bid on general construction contracts, even though I'm a $20 million business with a primary line of work that I've sized out of, there's no reason I shouldn't be able to get certified and bid. There are companies that are bigger than me, almost twice as big, that are bidding on those contracts. So what SBA has proposed to do for EDWSBs, by the way, it's never been that requirement for regular WOSB. The rule that said you could be any size as long as you do business in that line of work for regular WSB certification, but for EDWSB, you had to be small in your primary NAICS. I was like, why? What's the difference? Who cares? SBA has said, okay, no longer a requirement you be small in your primary NAICS to be certified as an EDWSB. No longer a requirement that you be certified small in your primary NAICS to be certified as an SDVOSB or a VOSB. So those are big opportunities now for companies that are in that world, that universe where they are have sized out of their primary industry, but there still are other secondary industries out there that they're either doing business in now or interested in doing business in. And maybe those companies have said, hey, I talked to a lawyer, talked to PTAC counselor, whatever. They told me I just can't qualify for the certification if this rule goes through as final. And it's important to know that these are all proposals, the subject to comment and then potential revision. But if this rule goes through, that would be a big opportunity for those companies because they would literally be eligible for certifications that they were not before. I think that's a big opportunity for folks out there. On the negative side, I'll mention that are potential threats that are looming. It depends on your situation, really. One is the question of self-certifying as a small disadvantaged business, SDB. And Carol and I have had this conversation before. He and I are of the opinion that there are a lot of companies that are checking that box when they're registering for SAM, because this is a self-certification in SAM, that are checking that box and they don't qualify. They don't actually meet the requirements. This podcast is not about what does it take to be a self-certified SDB. That's a whole different question, but it's more complicated than a lot of the people who are checking the box think. And it's essentially almost all the 8A criteria apply. So what SBA has said in this proposed rule is, hey, there is really not any formal vehicle that exists by which someone can challenge that certification, because there are no set-aside contracts that are being awarded to self-certified SDBs anymore, although it's still used when the government notes whether it's meeting its prime contracting goals. And importantly, it's used for subcontracting. The large primes have a goal, and so they are trying to award contracts to self-certified subcontracts to self-certified SDBs. So dollars and cents-wise, it really can't matter too. So what SBA has said is, you know, there's not really a formal process in place for challenging this. And so they are proposing to adopt a limited protest system for SDB status, under which the SBA itself, and importantly, the contracting officer, though not at this point a competitor, could come in and actually file a formal protest with the SBA if someone who has gone into SAM and self-certified as SDB. And what could that mean? It could mean you're losing a subcontract and have to redo your SAM, but it could also mean that if you've checked that box and you shouldn't have, you're going to be subject to broader scrutiny, because once the protest process kicks off, the potential for other penalties, False Claims Act even, is out there if you really had no business checking that box. So if you are somebody who has checked the SDB box in SAM and you're really not sure what it takes to be an SDB, you're not comfortable necessarily that that certification would stand up to scrutiny, be warned, because there is a potential that there could be a formal challenge of that. And if you're somebody who's, on the other hand, upset that you think a lot of folks are checking that box and they shouldn't, this is an area where you can go back to SBA and say, you know what, SBA, you could actually expand this and allow potential competitors to protest that too. So it could be even broader than what SBA is proposing. And then one more piece of potential threat, and we're going to get in, I'm sure, to the discussion about SBA's joint venturing changes that they're proposing here, and this would apply to all their programs. But at a big picture level, one thing SBA has done is they have essentially reinstated the concept of what's called a populated joint venture. And that's a joint venture that it has its own employees who will do contract work. And SBA had essentially eliminated that several years ago. And now in a limited fashion, SBA is bringing it back. Although in SBA, they're like, oh, it never really went away. We're just clarifying. But I can tell you, everybody thought that it was, that we were done with populated joint ventures for any sort of small business set aside, the socioeconomic sole source or set aside contracts. Now SBA is bringing that back in a limited context that I'll talk about, or I'm sure Michael and Carol will talk about as well in a little while. But where the threat lies is, I think that while a lot of this proposed regulation is pretty well done, I think the populated joint venture piece is half baked. Although they've sort of reinstituted the concept of a populated joint venture, they haven't then, to my knowledge at least, and it's certainly what it appears from the proposed rule, taken a hard look at their current joint venture rules and said, well, how does a populated joint venture really fit inside? And to my reading, there are pieces of some of their current joint venture rules that are essentially unworkable with a populated joint venture, leaving me, if I was an attorney, being asked by my client to draft them a compliant joint venture agreement for a populated joint venture. I would have no idea how to do that and still have the joint venture actually work as a working entity. So I think that's an area where if I was writing comments to SBA, I don't know if I would be pro or anti the populated joint venture piece in of itself, but I would say, SBA, you need to flesh this out more. Where the threat will arrive for a business is if you do one of these populated joint ventures, it's not really clear how that fits with the rules. In other words, the rules have been written around an unpopulated joint venture, one that performs work through its members. And so flipping that into a populated joint venture without having essentially a separate set of some of these rules, I think I wouldn't want to be the test case for that. I wouldn't want to be the test case for that. So that's another potential threat that's out there. And if I were advising clients these days, if this rule went final as is, I would say, I don't care what the rule says. You're doing an unpopulated joint venture, but somebody else can be the guinea pig.
Man, that's a great breakdown. I have a quick question. Well, I've got a comment, then a question, and then I want to get your thoughts on what Stephen just said, Michael. But regarding what you were talking about with the SDB, small disadvantaged business, and I think why this is also so high profile and important right now is because there's been the big push by President Biden's administration to escalate these SDB goals. Historically, that's been set at 5%. Last year, effectively, that moved to 11%. And for this fiscal year, the goal government-wide is 12% with an escalation up to 15%. By 2025. And I see that there's a lot of challenges that are already going to probably be happening. One being that the agencies are probably already having a hard time meeting just the 11% goal. And I think that they based it off of a number where they had like 10 point something percent utilization. But you got to go back to question, if there's nobody certifying, are verifying people that are just checking the box for SDB when they register in SAM, they get an award, and contracting officer says, oh, let's give that some SDB dollars, you know. What we do know is that through all of the programs, and historically, veteran, woman-owned business, anytime there was self-certification, there was a lot of misrepresentation. And it's not always intentional. It's just sometimes because the small businesses don't understand really what does it mean to be socially and economically disadvantaged, SDB. And so I think what's going to happen if this ever gets scrutinized or there's a study done that maybe 10% was not really a starting point to look at, I think, from like who was like legitimate SDBs. Maybe it's closer to 8%. I don't know. I'm just kind of speculating here. But my question on all of this, Stephen, is, do you think a comment to be made would be possible to suggest maybe an SDB certification program or in the lack thereof, maybe one of these entities out there that has done some of this stuff like WeBank and others in the past, do you see the need for maybe some nonprofit organization to set up a third party SDB cert to kind of have some type of verification point that an SDB is an SDB?
That's a great question. And I know I'm with you. This is just based on anecdotal data. I don't know of any comprehensive studies on it, but it is true that when they've studied self-certification in other contexts, they being often GAO, some investigative agency like that, perhaps an agency inspector general's office, they have come and found that a significant percentage of them are inaccurate, shall we say. And a lot of them, I agree, are not false. The rules, you know, not knowingly false. The rules are complicated and people get it wrong. But I've also had people who essentially told me, oh, I'm a minority, so my business is an SDB. And that's completely wrong. Like that's one little piece of what it takes maybe to be an SDB. They didn't know there's an economic disadvantage component, et cetera. They didn't really research the rules. And so I think there are a lot of folks out there who just kind of are assuming that they meet the criteria. My guess is if we, you know, and I think comments on this are great. My guess is if that SBA would say, we don't have the bandwidth or the dollars to do a certification program, that our, you know, our resources are devoted to 8A, which is essentially the formal certification for SDB status. Maybe that you could talk about a third party getting involved. I think that's an interesting concept. They used that in the woman-owned side for a while. What people complained about, of course, with that was that you had to pay them, right? And so a lot of people are going to say, well, I don't want to have to pay just to be self-certified and say I'm an SDB. Right. Any people who probably do qualify that they don't do it at all. So I kind of landed on just when I was thinking through this, well, maybe you could at least expand the protest process to allow competitors in. Contracting officers do protest, by the way. They file size protests. They file status protests. They may see a company and they're like, I'm not sure about you. I'm taking this to SBA. Yeah. But the easy way to get a lot of these reviewed would be to open it up to competitors. And it could even be a subcontractor competitor who's like, I would have gotten the subcontract if they were those guys. That could be tricky. But other prime contractor competitors to file for protest. And I know that you would say, well, the SDB certification wasn't necessary to the contract award because the government cannot award it. I think it's worth bringing up. And you're right to put that in the context of the government's 15% goal, because I think that if a study were done, you'd find that initial start plus percent was probably a bit of a mirage. And now when you're pushing the government to 15%, what you're doing is not giving the government at the same time necessarily the tools to understand whether that 15%, if you get there, is legitimate. Are these really SDBs? And so this is a step in that direction. And I think what you might see if you expand these protests and then you get articles written about the protests and it gets out there in the world, is that folks who've been a little bit easy come, easy go with their SDB certification, not really paying attention to it, like some folks I talked to are like, whatever, you know, I'm a minority or whatever. Or I literally had somebody, and I'm clearly not going to name names. It wasn't even a client. It was someone I was talking to at a conference who said, I feel disadvantaged. And I'm like, well, that is not a basis for a certification. But I think some of those folks would now pay more attention to what it means if they were reading an article about somebody who was getting protested, getting.
Yeah.
I did want to raise that because you and I have had that discussion, and it's one of the first things I thought about. Like, a threat to a lot of folks out there is that this certification that may have been in your SAM for years without a whole lot of thought, somebody may be challenging that now down the road if this goes through.
You just said that comment about, I feel disadvantaged. I think that's why a lot of people take the box. And they may, in fact, be disadvantaged in one component, right? Yep. You may be economically disadvantaged, but not at the same time socially disadvantaged, right? And unfortunately, there's not any economically disadvantaged small business program. So you have to have the two components to really truthfully be able to attest to that. So, Michael, you've been quiet over there. I'd like to come circle back to you to see, you know, what your thoughts are on what Stephen shared and opine on your own thoughts.
There's so much, and you know, Stephen, I think, hit a bunch of the good ones there. I'll hit a couple more while we have the time. One of the things that I think is interesting, and we never recommend you try to be on two teams chasing any sort of contract, but one of the things that apparently is fairly common is to see 8A firms that are on two or three JVs that are bidding on multiple award contracts. That's a thing. And you may be one of those people. If you are one of those people, the proposed rule is you will no longer be allowed to do that. You will only be on one team. That's it. No more multiple teams for companies that like doing that. So that I thought that was interesting. I mentioned earlier the one that I thought was a really good clarification where 8A JVs can win unlimited number of contracts. I can't tell you how many people that I run into that still believe it's limited to three contracts. And you may be on the call today going, oh, I thought we were only able to win three. We've won three. We've stopped pursuing contracts. Now you can fire that thing back up and go after it. This is not a proposed rule change. It's a proposed clarification. This rule is already in effect. So if you didn't know that, now you know it. The other thing that I think is interesting is some of the proposed rule changes to WSB, where the WSB can actually be managing and owning more than one company, as well as have a job. The SBA has looked at a lot of this and used the words, the current rule is overly restrictive on that WSB. So think about that. You first get into this and you have one contract, two contracts, and you're like, hey, it's a great contract. It's a multi-year contract, but it's not quite enough to pay the bills. So I'm going to go get a part-time job at FedEx or whatever, right? And you're trying to do that under the current rules. Like, no, you're not. You know, you now you've got this job, you know, or maybe you're going to get a full-time job because you've got employees working on it and you don't need to be in the business that much. That's a no-go today. So they're looking at a lot of this and saying, hey, it's overly restrictive and we're going to make some of those changes. I saw somebody just pop a comment in there, how many tribal 8As will be effective. This talks about tribal 8As and ANCs and all different stuff. So it's one of the reasons we recommend you go and read the summary. And if you don't want to read the summary, pull up the link to the Federal Register and just type in those keywords like tribal and see everywhere in there where it just mentions tribal. Because maybe you don't care if it mentions a lot of other things, but you want to particularly look at those specific areas. Go in there and query that. So I'll go back real quick to one of the first things that Stephen was talking about it's very clear that the SBA has been listening. I would argue they've been listening for a decade, maybe 15 years, and not taking action. So it's one of those things where on the one hand, it's extremely frustrating that they have taken this long to take action on a lot of this stuff. And on the other hand, mention to you that your voice matters. Like your voice matters a lot. And being a squeaky wheel about a lot of these things that have been a challenge for a really long time and constantly complaining about the SBA to get these changes in, which goes back to one of the points I made 30 minutes ago. Now is the time. Right now is the time. If you're going through that and you disagree with something, or as Stephen pointed out, you look at something and you're like, I am more confused now than I was before. Your comment doesn't have to be the exact changes they need to make, but it could be about requesting clarification. Hey, you say this in this particular paragraph, and I'm extremely confused. I think this is going to cause a lot of problems in the future. Please clarify these three things about what your recommended change is. It's extremely important that you do that right now while the SBA is collecting that information. I can't say that enough on the podcast today. They're open to it. So take advantage of it and go talk to them. Who knows, after this massive rollout of changes, they may say, look, the impact from the Govology and Coffee and Issues session was so crazy, you know, that we're going to postpone this and put out a new proposed rule change. Who knows, right? They could do that. Like they could be flooded with so many comments that they put out another, hey, this is our revision to the proposed rule changes, make comments again, or they just may make the changes. And after that, who knows when the next round is going to be? Are they going to make incremental changes each year? or are they going to sit kind of deaf for another decade before they go, oh yeah, all those things you've been talking about for the last 10 years. Yeah, we're going to roll out one massive change. This time we're just going to call it the changes to WSB, but we're going to change every status. You know, they may do that. And so we really don't know when the next opportunity is. So right now we have an opportunity to take advantage of it. And then as this comes out and we do have finalized rules, if you disagree with something, make your voice heard again. Like, you don't have to just take it. You can talk about these things. And you're also going to see once these rules happen, and this is something we haven't talked about today, there are subsets of these rules that happen within agencies. I see this all the time. DOE is one of those where I have a client right now who they're like, hey, normally the SBA's JV program, mentor-protege, works like this. But within DOE, they're basically saying, if you've done that program, then these six rules apply to you. And you can't do the following and whatever it may be. So there's subsets of rules that will be affected by this within agencies. And be aware of that, that it may change some things that may cause SBA to come back and make further revisions to what they're doing. But it's not just going to affect what's going on at the SBA level. There's subset of stuff that'll happen at the agency levels as well. And there will likely be some fallout from that type of stuff. So we'll have our ear to the ground, all of us on here, and trying to bring commentary to it as quickly as we can. So that's my 2 cents there, or 4 cents. I don't know what it was. It was a lot.
Thank you, Michael. And you know, also, I just want to say, you know, for the sake of our friends at the SBA as well, and I know that they've got a hard job on their hands as well, because historically, they've kind of been stripped of funding. And if there's anybody that can give feedback into some of their congressional offices, is like, hey, fund the SBA, you know, because when I worked at the SBA, I think they told me something like there was like 27 people in my district office when I worked there, and we were down to about 8. And so I know that they're trying to do a lot of things with very little manpower there as well. So I wish them the best as well. But Stephen, I wanted to just kind of circle back with you one last time, and then I think we can kind of like do a little wrap up, and then we can go to our Q&A. Before though, I apologize for those of you guys who could not get in. You're watching this on the live streaming service. Thank you for joining us. We're going to post this again, this very episode, at govology.com/issue. And you'll see all of our segments there that we've also done in the past. And I'm going to put a link here for the folks that are in our chat here to encourage you to continue the conversation at govology.com/nation. And again, that's our LinkedIn group. Just go ahead and request access and we'll get you there. If you have a question that you want to pose, I know Steven's in the group, Michael's in the group, I'm in the group, and we've got a lot of other SMEs in the group that can kind of chime in. So with that, I want to go to you, Stephen, for maybe kind of some final thoughts. I know you mentioned something about joint ventures. Was there more that you wanted to say on that front, and kind of just give a final recap on some things that maybe coming out of this small businesses should do in regards to how they comment on the all of these changes?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, to pick up the thread on something Michael said first, because I think he did a wonderful job pointing out a couple other of these opportunities and threats out there, this notion of can you be a joint venture partner on two JVs that are bidding on the same contract. As an attorney, I got asked that all the time. Can I do this? My answer was always, don't do that, not because the SBA regulation said one way or the other, but because there's a FAR provision called the Certificate of Independent Price Determination, FAR clause, that says you've arrived at your price without it, you know, any other offer having any clue what it is. And if you're the 8A member, the lead, it has to be the lead of two joint ventures. Yeah, you know what the other offer's price is. I didn't see how you could comply with that clause and do it. But I did want to point out that SBA, as part of this rule, has also proposed to adopt that same rule for hub zone, service disabled, veteran-owned small businesses /VOSB and the WSB-ED, WSB joint ventures as well. So SBA says we want the joint venture rules to essentially be consistent throughout, so we're going to do that. There was a question in the sidebar about whether the SBA is looking for full-time devotion from the owner of an 8A company. The answer is yes. And so what SBA has done is dialed back, as Michael pointed out, or proposed to dial back the requirement for spending time essentially managing a WSB or EDWSB. And SBA said that's overly strict. And actually, when I see it most of the time, it's usually a startup, somebody who wants to start up a company But they can't quit their job because the company's not paying their bills. It's not providing their health insurance. And so they're like, well, what do? I can't work full-time for my startup. We don't even have a contract. We're just submitting proposals. And SBA has agreed with that on the WSB side and is proposing to dial that back, whether it's an existing business that just has one or two contracts. It's a startup that you would not have to necessarily quit your job to manage your WSB until your company was in a position where that made financial sense for you and your family. But they have not done that on 8A. 8A is different. 8A is not for startups. And so SBA doesn't have that trumpeted in its regulations, say 8A is not for startups, but 8A is not for startups. They have this thing called a two-year in business requirement for 8A certification. It generally means that you have to have been doing revenues in your primary NAICS code for at least 2 years. And so SBA assumes that you are a slightly more mature business. You've been out there for at least 2 years and that you are in a position when you're applying for 8A certification that you don't need outside employment generally. And so there are a few exceptions to this, that, or the other, but in 8A, they've not proposed that change. So we've just hit on a few of these things. I would look at, if you're interested, definitely check out Josh's article for some great summary. I know my former colleagues over at Copernicus McCall Potroff have also done some blog posts summarizing some of the key rules regarding these changes. But also feel free to just, you know, who wants to spend their time looking at legalese. But as was mentioned, you know, pull up the rule and do a word search for the terms that interest you. If you're a hub zone, pull up that rule. Yeah, it's 300 pages. Okay, I'm not going to read all 300, but I'm going to see what it says about hub zone. And then you'll know what is out there. And finally, I would wrap up just by saying we've talked a lot about commenting, and we know that, that's something you have to do. It's another thing to do on your to-do list. I think SBA, all the procuring agencies that I, or federal agencies, and SBA is a procuring agency too, but all the agencies that I've dealt with over my years in the field, they are one of the best at actually reading and responding to comments. That doesn't mean that they will agree with you, but they might, and they will read it, and they will take it seriously, and they will then respond to it. And their next final will probably be the final rulemaking on this subject will probably be sometime early next year that'll come out. SBA will walk through and they'll say, you know, a commenter suggested X and we either agree, disagree, whatever. Or a bunch of commenters said, tell us more about how this power play joint venture thing is going to work because we don't see how a power play joint venture and also have the 8A partner do at least 40% of the work. Both things can't be true. And so they may say, well, yeah, that's a good idea. We're going to walk through and fix that. So this is your chance to make your voice known. Your comment doesn't have to be long and crazy. It could be as simple as I'm still confused by this, or we see a comment in the sidebar, has SBA brought more clarity to the affiliation rules only a little bit in the ostensible subcontractor affiliation rule. So maybe you say, hey, you know, I think this aspect of your affiliation rules is unclear. Could you also address that? And they maybe they will do that. So I do think it's worth your time. And you can just hunt and search for the pieces that affect you and go ahead and read some of those summaries too by Josh Frank, the folks at Copernicus McCall Potroff, by others out there who are credible sources who have read and are summarizing some of these things for you too.
Awesome. And I said, you know, another great resource to stay current on changes is that the smallgovcon.com blog that's up that you started and as you sold your business that now has been well populated by the attorneys that are there now at your former firm. And great blog. I mean, it was is one of my key resources as I try to kind of stay up to date on all these changes. And I know they always do a really good job of unraveling these things and kind of helping to translate what some of these changes mean for them, you know. So that's another great resource. Also here at Govology, I know that once this all pans out and gets implemented, we'll probably likely either recap all of these changes on an end of the year review, how we usually do an end of year review, or if it's something that is not all finalized until maybe spring or something like that, we may just do a special webinar just to talk about what has occurred within these changes. And those are always great ways to basically, you know, stay current on what's happening so you know the rules, you know what's happening and the whole nine yards. Last comment that I want to make, something that you said with regard to the two-year rule for 8A, I actually think even though it may seem restrictive, I think it's a good rule and it protects, I think, businesses because if you're only working part-time in your business, when you get into that 8A business development program, it's a limited time frame that you've got to basically make it happen. And so I encourage you before you get in, to really be all in your business and to be ready to counts. One of the best success stories that we've had was a company that basically went through our training before they even got the 8A certification. They already had a teaming deal with a big firm and won their first $3 million contract. And then they went into the 8A program. And then it's like they were set up for success from day one. And that's something to consider as well. So thank you for all of the great comments, Stephen and Michael. Final thoughts.
I have one final thought on this besides my go make a comment if you have one, is one of the good things that I saw out of this was it really felt like when you read the document, because I did read a lot of the 311-page document. As you read it, there is a feel in there that they are trying to get the programs on equal footing, where like today, when you look at a lot of stuff, you'll say, well, this applies to 8A. And you're like, well, how does it apply to WSB? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Let's go look. How does that affect SDVOSB? Well, I don't know. Let's go look. Yeah. There's a lot of what I would consider clarifying language that says 8A, Hub Zone, WSB, SDVOSB, and whatever, like trying to put those programs on an equal footing as much as possible. So I saw that. It kind of jumped out at me. And I think that's something where the SBA recognizes the frustration we have trying to interpret it almost as all these massively different programs and what's the rule under this one. Well, if you're a WSB, you don't have to follow that. But if you're an SDVOSB, then whatever. And so getting rid of that and consolidating the rules is huge for me. And I think it'll be great for a lot of clients so that there's not any confusion for them. Because what do you do when you have a client who is an 8A, Hub Zone, SDVOSB, WSB, tribal-owned, whatever, and they're like, well, under this program, I can do it, but under this one, I can't. What do I do? Well, they have to come and get clarification, and then it causes issues. And so I like seeing the direction that it apparently is going. So
awesome, man. Thank you so much for your comments and for sharing. And I think that it's time to wrap it up now and to go to the folks that are patiently waiting to ask some questions, those that have joined our Zoom call. Again, for those who couldn't get in it, if you're watching this, my apologies. Again, govology.com/nation if you want to continue a conversation or ask a question in there. If you didn't get a chance to do that, is a great place. And also a copy of this within about a week, we'll have it edited and published on our Govology platform at govology.com/issues. And you'll be able to find both the video version as well as the podcast version. And so for all you guys who are going to be departing now and joined us from our streaming services, thank you for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode of Coffee and Issues. Now we're going to take some questions. And for those of you guys who are still hanging out with us, if you could just raise your hand a little bit. And I want to set a couple of ground rules about the questions, because I know I saw some things popping up in the chat, which is kind of really specific to one particular business. So if you could post some of those over at Govology Nation, and let's try to reserve the questions for specifically the things that are regarding the proposed changes. So let's go into some questions. If you have those, raise your hands and let's get some questions. So
I'll set the floor a little bit on that one. I don't think we're going to be able to answer a lot of specific questions on it. You know, because it's proposed and there's so much here, we can probably answer some general questions, but we're not going to be able to get very elaborate like we normally like to do in the weeds on this stuff, just because it's such a moving target. So I apologize up front on that. This is more informational today. We'll try to answer some questions.
Yeah.
But we may just have to circle back, or may have to refer you back to the document to go see what it says on that. Because again, I know I haven't read the whole thing. Maybe Stephen tortured himself and read the whole thing.
I think what would be a good invite right now. So let's just jump in and get a few questions. If you guys have any that related to the content that you heard today that you maybe are not clear on. So let's take a couple of questions. And then again, let's post those, the remainder, if you have them, at govology.com/nation. That's our LinkedIn group. So you can either raise your hand, or I'm scrolling back through to see if we have any questions. I know that there was one. Let's go ahead and maybe take it. So can a large business have less than 10% ownership in an 8A concern without affiliation?
That's a good Steve question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it depends how it's structured. And so, you know, if you still have to structure it so that there's unconditional control by the 8A firm, that you still have at least 51% disadvantaged individual ownership or more. And depending on when this happens, you'd have to get potentially the SBA's permission for that change. But yeah, I mean, as a general rule, yeah, and that's not something that's addressed in this session or in these rule changes. And it can be as up to 40% as a mentor. And so the mentor-protege program allows a large mentor to attain an equity stake of up to 40% in the protege 8A company.
I have a slight twist to that question. I'd like your thoughts on it there. So let's assume for a moment that the company that's trying to get stake in the 8A is located in China.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would do that if I was the 8A company.
I wouldn't either.
You know, there's not an SBA rule that prohibits that. If the disadvantaged individual who owns the majority lives in China, that's a no-go. You have to be a U.S. citizen living in the United States to own the majority interest. There's no rule that necessarily prohibits a foreign country company from owning a 10% stake. That said, there may be all sorts of issues you'd face with regards to Trade Agreements Act or Buy American Act or security clearances. Doing cleared work. There's a whole suite of issues that would come up, especially when we're talking about China. You know, we're not talking about Canada or something like that. So it's not prohibited under the SBA rules, but I wouldn't just jump on that 10% stake right away without doing a thorough analysis of what that would mean for at every level of your business.
Yeah, I've actually seen, we've had, I think, four clients, which I'd never had a client in 20 years bring this up. And we've had four people reach out to us in the last 2 months that says, hey, I'm trying to get into this. There's a company that's owned in China that owns a 6% stake in the company. Talk to me about my challenges.
Right. That's interesting. You don't see a lot of that. I guess that's new.
I would suggest have a chat with your friendly GovCon attorney that specializes in federal contracting.
Yeah, because you're looking well beyond 8A now to what does this mean for you as a federal contractor, period.
Yep.
You know?
Well, hey guys, we're right at the top of the hour. So if you have remainder questions, again, please put them in Govology Nation and we'll try to do our best to get you some answers to those questions as we can. You know, like Michael said, there's still a lot that's not been defined with the rules yet. So I know that we're likely probably also going to probably come back here on this episode or this show once all of this is settled and do a part two to this now that the rules are out there. So I'd love to invite you back for that, Stephen. And again, thank you for being here. And thanks, Michael, as always. It's a pleasure to co-host.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Carol. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks, right, everyone. Guys. Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Michael.
All right, take care.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.